This is 89.9 WWNO. I'm Janae Pierre, and it's time for All Things New Orleans. On today's show, we'll talk with the founder and curator of the TED Women's Conference, which will take over the Crescent City next week. Then Jessica Rosegard digs into Chef John Besh's sexual harassment scandal, and we'll share another story from Bring Your Own. That's all coming up on All Things New Orleans. Stay with us. TED Women is a three-day conference empowering women and girls to become creators and change makers. The program of speakers, workshops, and events is coming to New Orleans next week. Joining me now to talk more about the conference is Pat Mitchell, founder and curator of TED Women. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So before we talk about the conference, let's spend a minute talking about your background. You're mostly known for your work as a journalist and producer. Then you basically just worked your way up from there. How did you begin advocating for women's leadership?
I think I've been advocating for women's leadership my whole life. Looking around a community in a small town where I grew up, I was dying to find more women in leadership positions. So I thought, they need to be there. I need to help them get there. And I spent my life using whatever opportunity or platform or advocacy I could find to create opportunities for other women. And that's what TED Women is all about.
Yeah. TED was launched in the early 90s. How did TED Women emerge?
TED had been around for a long time, primarily as a conference for technology, scientists, design, and I was going, as were a few women, very few, and I kept noticing how few women there were on the TED stage giving TED Talks. So I talked to Chris Anderson, who owns the TED conferences and chief curator, and complained. And he said, well, if you can do something about this, help us find women. And he jokingly said, I couldn't find a woman rocket scientist, for example, for this conference. So I took that as my first assignment. I found 10 and said, okay, here's 10. Which one of those would you like? And he said, you know what? Let's do a whole TED Women conference. That was 2010.
Okay.
And the team of women at TED and myself put together the first one, thinking we'd only do one. But it turned out that a global community came to watch the live stream and then started forming their own TEDx Women conferences all over the world. And by the end of that, year, we realized we had created a new global community and the opportunity to give the TED stage to women who weren't there to talk about women necessarily, but were there as scientists, doctors, physicians, actors, activists, farmers, explorers, women from every sector of life and work had an opportunity to use this global platform to talk about their big ideas.
And so you kickstarted that in 2010, and now the conference is headed here to New Orleans. So let's jump into it. What's the theme of this year's conference?
Not surprisingly, given that we're sitting in a city of iconic bridges, the theme is bridges, right? And we also are living in a time where there is a greater need for bridges. In all the ways in which we have created divides among us, this is an opportunity to look at the ideas that bring us back together.
Yeah, I was going to ask you to expound on that a bit because, I mean, bridges can mean both positive and negative things.
Well, we're looking at it from both of those points of view. We literally have one session called Build, which really is about building, quite literally building bridges with a young woman who builds bridges all over the world with the community, 7 days, foot bridges. And then going from there to a session on design. Design's not just about the way things look. Design is about the way we think, the way we speak, the way we interact with each other. So with architects, designers, social scientists, brain scientists, we're looking at design as a fact of our lives. Suspend. You know, sometimes we can't get to the other side of where we need to go unless we suspend some of the opinions about right or wrong. So Suspend is a session in which we'll hear from a lot of entrepreneurs who are giving us new ways of looking and solving today's challenges. Connect. Bridges clearly connect us. So in that session, TED Women does something that the other two big TED conferences don't do. And that is we put two people on stage to give one TED Talk together. And then, of course, you want to build bridges, but sometimes you want to burn them. You got to burn some bridges to light your way forward,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So we have a session on burning bridges, and that one includes a very up-to-date talk on sexual harassment.
Very timely.
Very timely. And many of the talks are, but all of the talks are timeless in that they are going to be posted on TED.com, and they go to the world. So they may have a city or a country as a focus, but they're global in their impact. And then the last day, on Friday, we have one session called Rebuild. Because after you burn some things and you walk away from some things and you realize where you've got some challenges, it's important to rebuild the structure, the love, the faith, the conversations that help us move forward.
Now, I understand that the TED Women Conference is bringing a bunch of speakers to the Crescent City. Could you highlight a few of them?
To highlight a couple, you know, we could have booked every single one of the speakers from New Orleans. I mean, there's such a wealth of great thinkers and doers here. But I'll just highlight a couple of New Orleans women that I know are loved here. Cleo Wade, she's going to come and share a poem that she wrote especially for us.
Eve Abrams,
colleague of yours,
yes,
right?
Indeed.
We're exhibiting a photo exhibition of her work and the docuseries that she's produced for NPR,
yes,
as a matter of
great.
Fact. Yeah. Deanna Van Buren and two or three other women on the stage will be talking again about design and architecture, specifically focused on how you build prisons that lead to a different kind of life following prison. And as I said, some partnership talks. There are 40 speakers talking about all those things. Themes, and in between some great poets. And this time we chose all of the poets from New Orleans.
That's great. Now, yeah. You mentioned some partnerships, and we have in studio your good colleague, Tina Clark. Could you tell us what
Do I get to tell you about Tina? I'm so glad.
Yes.
Because Tina's one of the reasons we're in New Orleans. She has a production company, DMI Live. So it's been a thrill to have Tina curate the music, as well as the food and the production elements and lots of other good things happening at TED Women.
Well, Tina, tell us a bit more. I mean, why is TED Women so important to you?
Well, Pat introduced me to TED Women several years ago. So when Pat talked to me about curating the music and experience, and we talked about New Orleans, I mean, I think my blood pressure just, you know, my eyes roll back in my head, because to me, I didn't feel like from experience, an immersion into a city or experience or culture in the United States, there could be anything better than New Orleans. But to give you a little bit about the music and food, I'll tell you who's going to be performing in the sessions. So, of course, the Preservation Hall All-Stars will be there.
Okay.
And they will be performing. One of the evenings, Jermaine Basil will be performing with the Preservation.
One of the city's jewels, right?
Oh, yeah. The jewel. And then on the main stage for the opening, we will have a great surprise in that, but we'll share it here.
Yes,
on the
ahead.
Station today. Deborah Cox will be coming in. She's opening the session. I asked her to do I'm Every Woman. See, I knew you'd like her.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where we are, you know, with the music. And then the food, I can tell you briefly. Pat and I had asked just this phenomenal food curator by the name of Keith Robinson. And so he just had a big time curating the food experiences. Some of those will be, which he's chosen a lot of female chefs and top female chefs in New Orleans, Coquettes, Carrollton Market, Herb Saint, La Petite Grocery, Willa Jean, and Compère Le Pen, who was a finalist in the Top Chefs.
We're going to eat well.
Yeah.
We're going to eat well, and we're going to have great music, and then we're going to learn and be inspired by Miss Mitchell and all she brings to the table.
So it's TED Women 2017 here in New Orleans. It sounds like it's going to be great speakers, good food, and some awesome entertainment.
And can I just say one other thing? TED Women is not your typical women's conference. It is a conference about ideas, and therefore it's open to men, and it's not free. You know, the talks go out free all over the world. But we have set up a special link for registering New Orleans residents, and we're hoping some people will choose to come and spend these 3 days with us. It's a very special experience. Thank you for letting us talk about it.
Yeah, thanks.
Of course. Pat Mitchell is the curator and founder of TED Women. You can catch her and other empowering voices at this year's TED Women's Conference, November 1st through 3rd. Find out more at tedwomen2017.ted.com. Celebrity chef and Louisiana native John Besh stepped down this week from the company that bears his name after an investigative report revealed allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct within Besh Restaurant Group. NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune, broke the story, and WWNO's Jessica Rosegard sat down with reporter Brett Anderson to talk about his report.
Brett Anderson, thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
Tell me how this whole investigation into Besh Restaurant Group started.
It began last Mardi Gras season in February when a friend of mine let me know that a mutual acquaintance had quit her job at the Besh Group's corporate office. And what I remember of that tip was just that I had the inclination to check it out, you know, to give her a call and ask what happened. That person was Lindsay Reynolds. She's a named source in the story. And she quit in a resignation letter that she sent in through email, which I received, in which she alleged that there was a culture of sexual harassment at the company. Following that conversation with Lindsay, I just felt as if it was my duty to make a few more calls to sort of see if I could verify what she was saying or to see if I could establish that what she was telling me was perhaps an exaggeration or not true. And that reporting just continued. You know, the trail never went cold, so to speak.
There have been stories of sexual abuse uncovered by journalists. You know, there have been some that have been false. There was a big one in Rolling Stone a few years ago. So it's a really difficult thing, and you really do have to spend a lot of time to make sure that everything is accurate, because those are huge accusations.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, we very much were striving to meet the highest journalistic standards of verification with what we ultimately published in the story. I say in the story that I spoke with 25 different women who each alleged that they experienced sexual harassment in their jobs at the Besh Restaurant Group. What ended up in the story were mainly allegations from sources who were named. I had 9 named sources in the story, and allegations that were verified by multiple sources.
Can you kind of explain the timeline in terms of your report, if you had planned to release it when you did, or if it was rushed because of some other incidents that came up?
The timeline was basically that I had virtually every source that ended up being cited in the story. I'd spoken to virtually all of them and had secured commitments from the women who ultimately allowed me to use their name in the story by mid-late summer. You know, that didn't mean I felt that my reporting was over. There's just a lot of little small details in when you're looking to put something out that involves such sensitive material that is time-consuming and it's resource-consuming. In August, I started to have more regular contact with the spokespeople at the Besh Restaurant Group. They had been aware of the investigation since fairly early on. I'd heard from someone at the public relations company that represents John back in March, asking if, you know, what I was up to, essentially. When we started negotiating with the Besh Group to see when we could meet, formally request to speak with John Besh and his partner, Octavio Mantilla, October 16th is when we ended up sitting down to speak with them, and it took some time to get schedules squared away and to negotiate what that interview was going to be and whether it was going to happen. And our approach from the moment we requested the interview until the story was published was that once we had verified all of our information and given the Besh Group an opportunity to respond to all the allegations that we were looking to put into the story, that we would publish as soon as we possibly could. And that happened to be midday on a Saturday.
Do you think that the timing of the Weinstein issue and then, you know, followed by the Besh report that you did, that the timing might have influenced people's reactions?
There's no doubt in my mind that the Weinstein coverage and other coverage in the news about, you know, sexual harassment allegations at Fox News, at Uber, and Silicon Valley more broadly. I do think while the Weinstein coverage did not influence our timing, I think it certainly has influenced the reaction to our story.
Were you at all surprised by what you uncovered in this 8-month-long investigation?
I have always respected very much restaurant professionals. I mean, I've been eating in restaurants more meals than not for over 20 years. I've been writing as a restaurant critic, professional restaurant critic, since I was 25 years old. And I have always respected people in that profession a great deal. But I can't say that I had thought deeply about what those working conditions are like, and specifically what it's like to be a woman in an environment that we all know can be coarse and can be sexually charged and is dominated by men. What surprised me most was hearing these women try to describe to me and get me to understand a certain level of trauma that they had felt they couldn't get anyone to sympathize with, because at the company they felt that the experiences that they identified as problems were dismissed as trivial, or if that they aired them, they feared that they would be regarded as disloyal, troublemakers, these kinds of things, or that it would get them branded as weak. That's what I was surprised by, just the normalcy. You know, people were describing things to me that had become normal in their workplace, and it was easy to believe them that it was normal. And getting me to face that it wasn't right, you know, it was revelatory, and that was the biggest surprise.
Brett Anderson with NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. His investigative report that came out a few days ago, John Besh Restaurants Fostered Culture of Sexual Harassment. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we're back with more BYO. This story was told on September 28th at the CAC and later produced by Lane Kaplan-Levinson. The theme of the evening was The Thing Is, and here Aaliyah describes a dress her grandmother made for her that she wears not only for style, but as a most honest representation of her homeland.
So I think a good place to start is something that we all have in common, fabric, textile. We're born in it, we die in it, we shield ourselves in it against the environment. We eat on it. We define ourselves by it in fashion. And sometimes we use it to transport ourselves to another place or into another person. At least I did. So I come from a place called Arabia Felix, Happy Arabia, the Yemen. It's in the southwestern corner of Asia, overlooking the African Horn. And I originally come from a tribe in the central highlands called Qubaita. But I grew up in the north, and our emblem was the snake, so we were known as the Hanashis. And I grew up in the north in a place called Sana'a, which is known as the Gingerbread City, because all of the buildings look like gingerbread houses. If you look at it online, you'll see. So one thing that was about Yemen was that it was really hard to get things in and out of the country. So objects became very precious. And one thing that was very precious to me, so we're talking about the late 80s, early 90s, I was like 7 to 13, and it was my parents' cassette tape collection, which they had brought slowly from the United States. And three of them were particularly special to me. Tina Turner, Ella Fitzgerald, and Whitney Houston. So this wasn't the time of the internet, so there was no way of seeing really how they reacted or photographed, so I was really left to minimal. It was like the cover of the cassette tape, and sometimes there was a little photograph inside. And so there was this one photograph of Tina in this total power pose, and it was just like, you're simply the best! And so I wanted to transport myself to her, but I couldn't without the leather pants. Another thing I need to tell you about Yemen is that in Yemen, we didn't buy ready-made clothes. It was a whole process to have clothes made. So you'd have to go and you'd have to buy the fabric, and then you go to the tailor, and then you decide if you want pockets or elastic or whatever. It was a beautiful process. But they didn't have leather, and nobody was going to make me any leather trousers. So I asked my mom, and I was like, do you have any leather trousers? I asked my dad, do you have any leather trousers? I asked my aunts and uncles. I was like, what's wrong with this family? We don't have any leather trousers. Up comes my grandmother, who is from the Central Highlands, who is a tribeswoman. She is slight. She's short. She has a presence about her. She has white hair, but she dyes it with henna, so it's this bright orange. She has this beautiful, colorful headdress. She has this beautiful dress all the time. She always carries a gun. So she is a total matriarch, and she's the matriarch of our family. And so she came not with leather trousers, but with a dress. And so she explains to me that she used the thread that was on here that she embroidered was actually dyed by the flowers that were in the village. She represented the harvest, and she represented the seasons in it. And most importantly, in the front, what she represented was the snake. And she said, remember that the snake represents patience and power. So fast forward a few years, I come to the United States, my family and I, and we raise our status from aliens to naturalized citizens. It's always very strange. And thank you for welcoming me. And so September 11th happens, and I start to look at Yemen from a different lens. I start to see it through the lens of the United States. I start to see it through the lens of Google. And what I saw was something really different from where I came from. What I saw was terror, bombs. I saw savage tribesmen. And I also saw that the snake was something conniving. It was something evil and treacherous. So everything that I identified with and everything that I came from was a villain. Our stories were told by our colonizers. And not only that, our stories, when they were told, were interpreted even before they were written, and the damage was already done. And then it was written in a language that was not ours. And then it was which was English. And then it was mistranslated into Italian, English, French, Spanish, Japanese, and so on. And so there is this crafted history of Yemen, and then there is the Yemen. And so I go back to this dress, which to me is the most honest document of what Yemen is. It is made by a matriarch. It is made by a woman who has lived there, who has grown there, who believes in color, who believes in beautiful symbolism, powerful symbolism. And also, if you touch this fabric, which you're allowed to, you are physically touching flowers of my village. So I come back to this fabric, to this dress, and why it has changed me. It has made me into an activist. Yemen right now is considered the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And not a lot of people know about it. There is no food or medical aid or people, journalists, coming in and out. This is why we're not hearing about it. Arabia Felix, that used to be happy Arabia, is happy no longer. 23 million people are not at the edge of famine, they're in famine. 8 children die a day, and 500,000 people have cholera. And this could be changed actually here. And we don't know about that. So this work in all made me an activist. It gives me the opportunity to make this a platform and to share about this. Art, in essence, is a borderland. And art, to me, is a place where everybody is welcome. My family in Yemen right now, if they were be able to get out, they would be banned and would not be welcome here. But this is not banned. This came in. And this has already shared enough knowledge among all of us, hopefully, to make even just a little bit of a difference. So art is power. And I dedicate this story to my grandmother, who passed in January. Thank you.
That BYO was in partnership with Project Object and the Stax Bookstore. The next BYO is on November 17th as part of Core 13's Always for Pleasure Festival. More information at bringyourownstories.com. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Janae Pierre. Visit our website to check out previous shows and be sure to catch us next week right here on 89.9 WWNO New Orleans and 90.5 KTLN Thibodaux Houma. Thanks for joining us.